Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Michael Rinn, Manager, Innovative Software Education, Intel Corporation. Michael, thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you. You flatter me. We'll see if I can match that praise here.
Well, it's interesting, Michael. You know, we met at an Education Council Summit, sort of a global summit last year, and I just found our conversation really interesting. So, first of all, Michael, perhaps you can tell me a little bit about how you got interested in computing.
So, I probably came in as actually a surprising number of us did through the side door as a practitioner of another discipline which relied upon computing. So I was doing quantum chemistry and solid-state physics calculations, which are entirely done in silico, as we called it, in coordinating with physical experiments as best we could. And this goes right back to grad school. I happened to come out of grad school in the early 90s when there was just a burst of interest in parallel computing, parallel supercomputers, really, and almost every possible approach and topology was attempted by companies, most of which are gone now. But those of us in the game at the time were motivated to learn how to use these machines to solve a physics problem, essentially. After a while, it turned out that what we had sort of considered to be incidental skills turned out to be interesting to other places like Intel. So there was a career shift there.
So you did some of your research at McGill University, is that correct?
Certainly my grad studies research, right.
So quantum mechanics, so that's interesting.
It's funny because when I began that study in the 80s, I had no notion that there was any practical application of it. It was more like doing a degree in philosophy. It was just a very interesting branch of science, which combines sort of physics, math, and chemistry into one. But then a funny thing happened. By the time I got out, computers had a state where simulations were becoming, if not quite useful, at least intriguing. And eventually they did indeed become useful. So doing experiments on the computer, modeling essentially, became a discipline in its own right.
Now, can you describe your work prior to joining Intel?
Straight out of school, I got a job with a company, Accelerus is their name now, and that was a company actually developing modeling software. And because that field was relatively new, it had a heavy academic tone. We were sort of joined at the hip with top researchers, and at my end in the company, our mission was to, you know, release robust code for users to run their modeling. But because of at least the state of the art at the time, we were pretty much forced to, which was fine, directly involved in the research ourselves. It was fun.
So did you release any commercial products that we're familiar with?
You wouldn't be familiar with them. DMOL is the name of the program that I was most involved, that I probably touched most in terms of code. It's a density functional code. There are more famous ones than that. Many people would have heard of the code Gauss, for example. We did not work on that one, but that would have been a rival approach, commercial approach to what we were doing.
So can you profile your work, that is your prior work at Intel?
Prior to my current?
Yes, that's correct, at Intel.
So as I mentioned, I first came to the attention of people at Intel. It was a funny connection. I was working at that company, but we did joint work with one of the national labs in New Mexico, and they had all those machines I mentioned, a variety of parallel computing systems, one of which was manufactured by Intel. All of the machines were notoriously difficult to use, so only the geekiest among us, you know, could eventually sort of make them sing. And it was through that interaction with, you know, the Intel machine, I came to know what was going on at Intel. So I was hired initially to join an effort, Intel, I guess, more into technical computing at that time. This would have been in the late 90s.
And then what are your current research interests and roles?
So at the moment, my team and our mission is to bring parallel computing into universities. But it's very much analogous to, you know, what I described earlier when computational modeling was new. Because some aspects, at least, of parallel computing or its use are new. In order to bring that to the university, you have to be pretty heavily involved or at least aware of what's going on the research side of parallel computing. So once again, I've stumbled into a kind of fun combination where you have to be working with the source of the knowledge and at the same time the people who are going to utilize that knowledge. In this case, as we hope, university professors who will pass the wisdom on to their students.
So what are your feelings on field programmable gate arrays or FPGAs to do parallel computing research and for education?
I think FPGAs are interesting. They've been with us a while. I think they are superb in certain niches, in the hands of masters of that. You know, if you have access to one and sufficient skill, they're great for prototyping and trying things out, I think. My guess is that will continue a key, you know, an interesting role of FPGAs. I'm not in the school of thought that thinks FPGAs will come a normal way of doing things. It'll happen if you prototype on an FPGA, you learn what you can, and then at some point, the things that work really well, you just imprint into the next chip design.
I see. So what kind of platforms do you offer to educational institutions so that they can sort of investigate parallel computing?
Now, this is kind of fun. We just opened up something we're calling the ManyCore Testing Lab. And ManyCore is a word I should pause and describe. The industry has been using the word multi-core to describe the, you know, starting and current commercial offerings, which are typically two or four or more recently six cores on a particular die. Server chips have eight, and, you know, there are announcements for more than that by a variety of companies. But at some point, as your core count goes up, the challenges of making any particular application use that many cores well and efficiently and get a decent performance, the challenges really ramp up steep. It's not terribly difficult to get a noticeable gain on an application with two cores or four. It can be horrendously difficult to get decent gains on 32 core systems. It's been done. I mean, the people in high performance computing, that entire modeling science simulation crowd, you know, that I came from, has developed really fine tuned, getting good scalability on lots of cores. But those are very particular workloads, very particular kinds of applications. Whether it can be done more generally across, say, you know, non-numeric types of applications, that remains to be seen. So in order to just help, really university professors get familiar with these challenges and sort of globally develop a portfolio of good examples, do this, don't do that, we've made available a set of 32 courses. Fortunate to be four chips with eight cores each. You can have a many-core system available. So we've actually made this many-core testing lab available to academics to come and play.
So I just should notify the audience here, or the listening audience, that is, that we're employing wireless communications, and sometimes you may hear a bit of a pop in the background, and that's just the nature of wireless communication. So just hang with us. Okay, in terms of the shift in computing hardware to parallel systems, and we know now that it's well underway, and that sequential chips are no longer designed in the era of von Neumann architecture passes into history, how can we generally be best prepared, and for what are we preparing exactly?
That's a good question. The shift from, you know, single core chips to multiple cores is really being driven by, almost in street terms, you know, by the need to do something clever with all those transistors, which Moore's Law tends to give us. So the Moore's Law, just to review, is sort of the doubling of the number of transistors on a given chip over a certain time period, let's call it 18 months. Now, historically, that has always correlated very nicely with performance. You know, so from the user's point of view or the application point of view, we get more transistors from Moore's Law, we get more performance more or less automatically. But the design techniques which, you know, helped that correlation along have shifted and in some cases sort of reached the end of, you know, a point of diminishing return, say. So chip designers had to go in a different direction. Okay, we've got this big transistor budget. Let's try making multiple cores, multiple execution units on a given chip. So it's really driven by chip physics. Now, given that, what is the opportunity there? And there is, in principle, an awful lot of computing power coming online, you know, with each increase in the core count, you know, with successive generations, and we'll see more that sort of scaling going forward. But it means that people who write software will have to get a lot savvier about how to do that. And I think that's a huge challenge, really, but also a great opportunity. It's fun. Many people have made this remark that, and I'll repeat it, and I agree with it, that it's fun again. You know, it's just not sort of routine, okay, new chip, everything is faster. Now it's more intriguing. You have to do things differently, and it's more challenging.
Now, can you describe the major parallel programming models?
I guess you could say there are two. On the sorts of platforms we've been discussing, the sort of multi-core and eventually leading to many-core systems, sort of shared memory systems with, you know, the chips are there in the box as compared to clusters. Anyway, in the shared memory systems, the dominant approach is threading, you know, generically threading, whether it be in a C-derived language or Java or a .NET managed type language. The implementation is all done through a threading model. The other one that is pretty much the norm in high performance computing is a message passing model. So, and that was sort of foisted upon that community. This is my old community for the nature of the platforms they work on. They work on distributed platforms, so threading wasn't really an option for them. But it turns out that message passing is a really good way to do those problems. So that community is entirely single model. And I would say that sort of on the consumer level, you know, traditional mass computing, they've settled on a threading model. I'm not sure, and this, I'm going to speak personally here, definitely not for my company. I'm not sure the threading model, the threading approach is sustainable.
I see. So I guess some of this maybe ties into work that's being done in Europe at ETH, for example.
Tell me about that. I'm not familiar with it.
They have a project called Daryl Fish, and they're looking at parallel computing and sort of solutions in parallel computing with new operating systems and that kind of thing. So
it's definitely a good time for innovation, and that's part of, you know, suddenly it's fun again. I mean, certainly the people who take thread-based approaches are coming up with some very sophisticated approaches, particularly for trying to trap errors. With the threading approach, and this is the reason I think it's ultimately not probably the prevailing model, even though it is now. There's a very peculiar bug you get with at least current threading approaches, which is it's not deterministic, and so you have accesses to memory which are not under control of the program designer. We probably need a deterministic method, and message passing is more or less that, so we'll see what happens.
Well, that's interesting.
If you're an educator, what do you teach? I get that question a lot. You know, we'll have this sort of a conversation. They say, okay, I get it. What do I tell the students? And the best answer I can give is, you know, equip them with flexibility to deal with evolving parallel models. That's pretty easy to do, right? It's like, as I said, this is a challenging time.
So what can you say about the time lags between research findings and classroom experience?
Oh, boy. I think traditionally, and particularly in my own academic training was in the physical sciences, the research would be years ahead. I mean, it would just take forever, you know, almost a generation before that became, you know, research became the commonplace, say, undergraduate wisdom. I think in some sciences it moves faster. I think the biological sciences move faster just because they have to. You know, the textbooks become obsolete a lot quicker there. But I think now in computing, and maybe for the first time in a generation, it's changed fast enough that maybe if you're a computer science educator, it might be better to think more like a biologist. Hey, my field is changing so fast that probably every summer I'm going to have to revise what I'm going to teach. Now, that hasn't been true traditionally. It's been more like, I don't know, classical physics. You know, you can use the same course you took yourself when you were a student. That's not going to be true in computer sciences now. So the lag time, you know, so my general observation is that in many fields, and I would say computer sciences has at least traditionally been one of those fields where there is a significant lag between the cutting edge research and, you know, what shows up, say, in an undergraduate training. One of the things we hope to, you know, my team and project at Intel is accelerate that, you know, have that, shorten that gap in time.
So actually, sort of building out into the future, maybe 20, 30, 40 years, what do you think about quantum computing? Do you see anything on the immediate horizon, let's say in the 10-year horizon or 15-year horizon, or do you think it's really far off?
Wow. So now we're getting really speculative. Although, you know, I kind of get it. The algebra involved in quantum computing is extremely straightforward. I would encourage any curious undergraduate to check it out. You can learn it quickly. The challenge there is, okay, the devices, how do you build such a device? Right now, the ones that do exist are fragile, right? They're research, you know, investigative things. And they've really, as far as I know, just focused on a single, of course, important topic, which is code cracking, right? So encryption cracking. It looks like you know, they're having a good time over there, and it's very promising for that one problem, you know, in sort of singular research lab accomplishments. As for quantum computing becoming more generally useful and even being a normal thing, even let's say up in the cloud, hard to see. It's very hard to see that. I don't want to be the guy who says, no, it won't work. But honestly, I can't beyond what's being done with it now. So even extrapolating out to suppose it's easy to make the device, I don't know that there's a mass market for code for password cracking computers.
What are some of the university industry collaborations now underway?
So I'll cite one that my team is fairly close to, we track, which is there's a joint sponsorship between Intel and Microsoft currently at two universities, at UC Berkeley and University of Illinois Champaign. And they are both, they're parallel research, they're long-term, substantially funded efforts with really some of the best people in the game. And the hope there is that, I mean, both Microsoft and Intel and indeed the whole computing industry depends upon this parallel computing thing getting traction, you know, getting big traction. So the hope there is that out of some of that research come directions to go. My team tracks it, looking to close that gap we mentioned earlier between research finding and teaching, you know, as soon as something turns up in either of these joint lab projects at Berkeley or Illinois, as soon as something that shows up that looks good for teaching, you know, we just grab it and try to distribute it out to our academic community.
So do you have any tie-ins then with the Berkeley Emulation Engine and or B and then Beehive?
We don't. We work more. The project I mentioned at Berkeley goes by the name of Parlab, so P-A-R-L-A-B. For those who'd like to Google it, there's definitely some fun stuff going on there. But it's much more in the software side.
You recently spoke at a conference, and this involved parallel computing. Can you tell us more about this conference and the outcome?
Yeah, the conference you mentioned is the SIG CSC, so the Special Interest Group Conference on Computer Science Education, an ACM conference. It turns out to be the primary one for that community. It's largely an American audience, but it does have an international participation, and it's certainly the big conference for these guys for the year. We started participating in that in 2008 as it first came to our attention, so that's how new the project that I'm involved in is. And we just got in initially as an industry sponsor, and we went and checked it out, you know, did the usual industry exhibitor booth. But little by little have gotten more engaged, and so in this recent one I had encouraged my own team, you know, most of whom are PhDs themselves, I said, look, you know, you guys have good ideas, submit them as papers or tutorials or workshops, you know, throw your hat into the ring in the refereed, you know, competitive game. So we did have, so I think that's a more legitimate and certainly a better engagement with the academic community has tried to meet them on their own terms, so to speak. So I was lucky to have one of the keynote talks at this conference. It was a terrific opportunity. I mean, the other two keynote speakers were people I had heard of. So it was sort of humbling, you know, to be on the same list as these others. But I used that slot to talk about parallel computing, and I took a couple of approaches to try to jolt the audience. And now here the audience is primarily computer science professors. There were maybe 1,200 of them, so this just gives you an idea of the scope of the conference, the size. I said, well, here we are, you know, that where Moore's Law continues, but it doesn't automatically translate into performance, computer performance. Is this a problem? And, you know, by analogy, I showed a private aircraft, a Cessna four-seater, a fine design from the 1950s, and I showed a picture of another one from the present day. The performance is essentially identical. They look the same. And so here's an industry that was the most glamorous one of the previous century. And in that particular niche, sort of the consumer niche, if you will, It just flattened out. The performance flattened out. So is this possible? Could this happen to us? I personally don't think so, but I wanted people to be aware, you know, that this certainly has happened to other industries where at the time, you know, they reached the plateau. No one could have imagined that was the plateau. So I led off with this. The other thing that was kind of fun is we at Intel sponsor an academic community of people, of universities really, who have signed on to introduce parallel computing right into their undergraduate curriculum. So if they're a member of our community, that's an indicator that they are doing that or they're actively, you know, implementing it, so they're about to do that. It's about, how many schools do we have now? About 1,800 universities worldwide. But here was this audience of primarily American computer science educators, and I showed them a chart sort of broken out by where were these universities that are doing this, and 85% of them are outside of the U.S. And that definitely got their attention. So I think if there had been a place, it was to some extent dissipated by that chart. You know, it's the rest of the world is doing it. So American universities, please don't get leapfrogged.
Can you describe your roles with nonprofits and your goals?
Well, that would be nonprofits being universities. Then, well, you know, I'll go back, circle back to that academic community. So I mentioned that we have about 1,800 enrolled. What that means is, you know, we say, you know, please come and join this effort. It doesn't cost the universities anything. What they will get at least is classroom teaching licenses to any of the Intel tools that make sense to them. They'll get access to all of the material that's developed by that community, by us, by any of our joint efforts with the research labs. And it's a place, a sort of a meeting place, a watering hole, if you will, for people like-minded solving problems of how do you teach students and how do we really shift the teaching to encompass parallel. So one of the questions I continue to get, and it's certainly a fair question, say, well, you know, we teach so much, you know, the curriculum is already so saturated with topics. And okay, I get it that this parallel thing is also important, but doesn't that mean I have to leave something out? So what do I leave out in this zero-sum game? And we hear that question at least once a week. And I think it's probably not the best way to think about it. I think we probably don't leave anything out. But what you do is treat the same topics with an understanding that the, you know, all the computational techniques, the algorithm deployment, let's say, the implementations, will be done on a parallel computing platform and not on a sequential one. So you're still teaching algorithms. You don't leave that out. But you teach it in a particular way that recognizes that the hardware underneath has fundamentally changed. So anyway, we have this sort of conversation, and we equip the people in this community as best we can, sometimes with micro-grants for curriculum development. Sometimes we will arrange workshops for them. And as I mentioned at the top of this talk, we have the mini-core testing lab where they can, members of this community can log in and try, you know, try their hand at 32-way homework assignments, let's say. So there's an example of a collaboration that my team's directly involved in.
And you talked about working with nonprofits in terms of universities and, you know, the research community and with students, but you also have your volunteer activities with nonprofit societies, for example, the Association for Computing Machinery. Can you describe some of your work there?
So I work with ACE Education Council. This is where we met, you and I, as a sort of an industry. I bring an industry point of view to the curriculum development. And my key interest now, you know, I joke with them, I joined it right around the time there was a U.S. election campaign underway, so I joke with them, I was sort of a one-issue candidate. But I joined them with the notion to say, you know, so let's explore this matter I just mentioned. You know, if parallel, the fact that all the hardware is parallel now is going to change how the discipline is approached or delivered. How is it going to change? Where is it going to change curriculum guidelines in particular? So the ACM Education Council and ultimately the ACM Education Board produces periodically a set of curriculum guidelines. They did their most recent update in 2008, so I sort of just missed that train. You know, I joined them after that was published. But they are receptive. I have to say, you know, these guys are very serious, a terrific bunch to work with. I'm very happy, you know, to be invited to contribute at the ACM Education Council. And fortunately, my own management at Intel recognizes the value, so I get time to do that.
There's another area that we share in common, and in fact, I was a judge at the International Science and Engineering Fair held in San Jose, but you've also been a judge, and that's a volunteer effort as well, trying to contribute to society, but also to students and so on. Can you share one or more stories about your experiences judging at this International Science and Engineering Fair?
Sure. I've got a whole a pile of stories. Unfortunately, I didn't get to do it this year, but I really do try to get there because it's always inspiring. I judge in the physics category. So the International Science and Engineering Fair for audience, ICEF, has it's sort of like the Olympics of secondary school, high school, science projects. And so by the time they get to the ICEF, it's a worldwide, competition. And the students are seriously bright. Most of them, by the time they get to, you know, this level at the finals, they've been well coached. And it's just fun, you know, interacting with very bright people at any age. And, certainly you see a different perspective. I will share one, story. The winner of, as it turned out, it was the winner this year in the physics category. A student named, Erica De Benedictis was a winner last year. So I remember, you know, speaking with her, interviewing her as a judge last year, and she and her team last year had implemented a specific astronomy problem. It was finding asteroids. So it was a lot of image processing, a little bit of orbital physics, a lot of data crunching, and they had decided to get the job done. It had to be, their software had to be implemented in a highly parallel code. Now, these are teenagers, right? And they said, yeah, it was a little bit difficult at first. We had to think and, you know, from the point of view of the processor, we weren't used to doing that, but we did it. And I found this fun for a couple of reasons. One is here are some people who had developed some serious programming skills, but as incidental to their main goal, which was to solve a science problem. But the other thing was more interesting from a computer science education point of view. Here were high school kids who had just, by the way, mastered the intricacies of parallel computing, at least mastered sufficient to do their project. And they definitely do it. I was able to quiz my own specialty, so I was able to quiz them in some detail. And they definitely knew what they were doing. What this brings to me, you know, back in my day job of working with universities, when we have the discussion of, well, how early can we introduce parallel? You know, isn't that a really advanced topic? We don't want to scare off the lower level undergraduates. I say, look, kids come up, they don't know what's hard already. So these ICEF kids didn't know parallel computing was officially hard. It was just something they do, and they proceeded to do it. It's really good to get a perspective, a different perspective going to judge. So I enjoy it. I will try to get back to that every year. You were there this year. What did you find, if I may turn this around for just a moment?
Well, in particular, there was one project which is an automatic parallelization through dynamic analysis. And in fact, it's an 18-year-old student, and he won the computing science category this year.
Oh,
and it was all about parallel computing. And doing real-time dynamic analysis of the sort of the runtime environment and doing allocation based on that. So he actually, I believe, placed in the top three overall. He also won the best in category in computer science. And, of course, he also was one of the winners from the ACM, you know, awards that are offered there. And it's specifically in your area. So.
Oh, this sounds like somebody I need to get to know. So another great example. I mean, the science fair is terrific.
So you also mentioned, I believe, at the Education Summit last year that you saw this project where a student had produced some kind of device and he had different iterations. I don't know if you can recall that story or not, but I thought it was just fascinating.
Yeah, this was, it was a few years ago. It was the first time I'd ever judged, and again in the physics category, and a student had actually built an atomic force microscope. You know, normally these things will set you back a few million bucks. It's relatively new technology. I believe the inventors of this, there were a couple guys from IBM Switzerland lab, the Zurich lab, got the Nobel Prize in the late 1990s. So it's a relatively recent thing, and exotic, and certainly exacting. And this German student, as it turned out, he did win, had built one, and he had it on the table working. And he went through, and he had broken down all the components, you know, what had to work, the different pieces of it. So, you know, how do you bring the probe close enough to the surface when you're sort of at atomic distances there? You know, how do you control that? And then how do you move the probe, you know, in order to scan and essentially get a picture of the atoms on the surface, in his case? And he described his, he had his false starts there too. It was great. He said, I thought this might work, but it didn't. So I tried this other way. And it was a lot of trial and error. It was a really Edisonian approach to it. But in the end, he had it done. The other thing that was very impressive, not only was it working, you know, right in front of us, he had a bill of materials of the part. It essentially done it with off the shelf parts. I think it was 48 euros was the total cost of this device that he built. So it's an extraordinarily clever project, and yeah, he won hands down, I would say, that year. So occasionally you get those sorts of outliers.
And I recall you saying that you, when you were conversing with a student, I don't know if it was this one in particular, but it was like you forgot that they were, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18, and you were thinking it was like one of the researchers at one of the Intel labs.
Oh, you know what? That's right. That was another case. That was yet another case. You're right. It was a student who was using, it was an optical tweezers project. So that was a terrific project. And in this case, the student didn't have to build everything, had access to university equipment, but definitely understood. And this is all kind of applied quantum physics here. So I have a PhD in this. So I just, over time, you're right, I sort of forgot that I was talking with a high school student, because we just had a normal sort of one scientist to another chat about the project, the challenges and the results and so on. And it was only later, I'm walking away, now wait a minute, that was a high school student. So yeah, ICEF is great at sort of sifting through and finding those extraordinaries. And you know, that really makes it worthwhile to keep going back.
And as I indicated, you probably would want to talk to the student whose project was on automatic parallelization to dynamic analysis, because they also won an innovation award on working on something of an immediate challenge. And I was just fascinated by that work, and I know it just sort of parallels what you're doing as well. So
it's very close, and you're right. And Stephen, let's follow up after this chat. And I'll contact that student. I'm sorry I missed this.
Now, which disruptive experiences most shaped your life and work?
Oh, boy. I don't know. That's a wide open kind of question. What disruptive experience, you know, shapes your life? We have a 3-year-old at home, you know, so certainly his arrival was disruptive and shapes your life schedule. Oh, boy. In more conventional career tracks, haven't really had what I would call cataclysmic or big, you know, epiphany of experiences. It's been more gradual. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I was kind of like those students at the science fair who learned programming to solve a different problem. It was sort of how I got into, parallel computing, after all, and sort of deep performance concerns computing. It was a gradual thing, though. You know, it was a sort of skills acquired over years, and then at some point just pursued primarily those instead of the sciences. You know, you have some regrets leaving something that, you know, compelled you to invest the years of study and then work. But certainly it's a fun job now, and it still touches important research.
You know, if you look at the ecosystem of your life, you know, past, present, and perhaps even into the future, can you name someone who inspires you and why this is so?
I guess, yeah, I'm glad you gave me a heads up on the forehand. I guess, you know, think back, and this may be almost a cliche, you know, for someone who came out of physical sciences, but when I was up at McGill, this was again in the 80s, they invited Richard Feynman, the physicist Richard Feynman from Caltech, to come up and give some lectures and, you know, just essentially interact with the physics department. So I'm an undergraduate at the time, right? And it turned out Feynman is this really down-to-earth guy. And I mean, of course, we'd all read his, you know, Feynman lectures in physics, and we all knew, you know, he's quite a famous character in the field. But he also was just informal, you know, sharp, witty, easygoing guy. And he just spent one afternoon hanging out with the undergraduates in the lounge there, in the physics lounge. And it was a pretty inspiring moment. I mean, some of the things that he said stick with to this day. So I suppose if there was a historic, you know, pivotal figure that I had a brief encounter with that was influential, I'd have to cite that one.
Now, this is a really difficult question, and that is, what are the challenges that you were not able to overcome?
Well, yes, it is a difficult question. I mean, everyone has aspirations that usually exceed their achievement, and I've got plenty of those. Certainly there are certain problems you want to solve, you know, in Well, just go back to grad school, for example. I was trying to solve some fairly fundamental things, which, you know, looking back is a ridiculous hubris. I eventually had to back down and do a sort of ordinary incremental thesis just to get moving. But yeah, you know, you have a notion, it'd be fun to solve once you comprehend, you know, that there's a problem there that needs to beg solution. And then you try it and hack at it, and 6 months later you've not solved it. So I would expect that every work scientist has had that kind of experience at back.
What would you describe as your top innovative achievement?
Well, it wouldn't be in science. Actually, it turned out that this is through an odd pathway. All that experience I mentioned with the various machines in the early 90s that implemented many different ways of doing parallel computing, along with the many different ways in the hardware were different ways of expressing that, you know, for the programmer. And those of us in the game at the time, we just had to learn them all and be able to port, you know, among the various sort of standard for intrinsic parallelism into what would not, you know, would be serial code initially. Well, it turned out, I arrived at Intel, and my first year there was this committee being formed called OpenMP, and Intel was invited to contribute, and it somehow fell to me to represent Intel's interests at that committee. But in a way, it was perfect, because I had my notebook of pet peeve wishes about all those varied standards, or non-standards, those varied proprietary approaches to it before. And the OpenMP was an attempt, I believe successful attempt, to consolidate all those approaches into a single standard. The committee did get that to happen, and it was fun. I was a minor player, but it was fun to have sort of my own wish list that I had already logged, implemented, and realized in a standard. So, you know, after that got done, the OpenMP 1.0 standard got done, and I sort of moved on to other work and handed it off to a very well-qualified individual at Intel who's still doing it.
You know, for the audience, there's just so much information out there, so let's see if you can do some collaborative filtering. Which resources would you recommend?
Oh, boy. You know, everyone reaches to Google first, of course, right, these days, to pick your favorite topic. And that's fine. That's gonna happen. But there are some of us are trying to, it's back to parallel computing, you know, sort of the topic I'm familiar with. The resources for that, some of us are attempting to aggregate and organize resources there, particularly for teaching. In fact, the ACM has just released, they announced it at that SIGC conference in March of this year, a website to aggregate teaching material. We have one for the academic community, and there are others who are doing it, and we try very hard to point to each other and be aware. But what the value is of such sites, you know, the people who organize it, it's not for searching. I mean, you can search and it will ultimately find anything in principle. But it's kind of the commentary, the evaluation, the context, trying to provide a context for the material there, the educational material for parallel computing. So it's a little bit of a plug for our own efforts, but I'd recommend people go to software.intel.com/academic, and they'll find a continuing effort there. And we definitely point to the ACM and the other efforts that are terrific. And I would recommend people, you know, go, in addition to their own Google searches, leverage these other efforts, you know, by people who are out and sort of checking on what's there and make it easier to find.
I guess the ACM portal that you're talking about is the one called Ensemble?
Yes.
Right.
And you know, kudos to them. It's a great start and a very promising effort.
Or I should say ACM is a contributor. Perhaps it's the National Science Foundation as well that's part of that.
Yeah, there have been others, and, you know, there are several others I can't name off the top of my head. They go by names like Shodor, you know, which is also a NSF-funded effort. And I don't keep them in my head because we put them on our website, and the folks who do Ensemble also do the same thing. They point out to other aggregator sites or commentating, what do I call them, textualization sites. So yeah, the Ensemble site is a good one. I'd recommend going there.
Now, can you provide your technology roadmap for the future?
Well, within the confines of what we're discussing, we're, you know, multi-core chip to many-core chip. So, for example, back to the many-core lab we're making available. That's, you know, 32 cores that are identical to each other. Their access to memory is a little bit different, you know, so it's a little bit of a non-uniform memory system. But the cores themselves are homogeneous. And that's pretty much where we are right now. Now, along come, you know, our friends in who make graphic processors, which are, you know, in certain slices, you know, I have to admit, they have a compelling story for a very particular kind of application. And Apple has been peddling, I'm sorry, I'm jumping around a little bit, I'll get to the point in a moment. Apple and others actually have been peddling the notion that a compute-intensive workload should be able to work on any of the processing elements available to it. There's even a language under development, OpenCL, designed specifically to allow, to enable programmers to address, say, I'm going to do it on one, you know, one of each of the processors available to me, and they may be different kinds. So all that, sort of what that to me points to is the future, the roadmap of processing processors is they won't be homogeneous, rather heterogeneous. It's pretty easy to imagine. I'm not giving away any secrets here. This is a commonly discussed issue. That, you know, why limit the design of a CPU or a processor to, you know, over and over and over the same specific core design? Why not have specialized units that can more efficiently execute particular kinds of workloads? So I think the future is heterogeneous, many core processors, and, you know, that will present even more interesting programming challenges.
And I guess there's things like mobile computing and cloud computing and all of those areas as well.
Oh, yeah, the used models, I mean, that's just exploding. That's an entirely different, let's say, axis, you know, on the big multidimensional graph of computing and how it's changing. Yeah, I've been focused on a very particular one here, but you're right. You know, computing going mobile, it's happened already. Think of it. The a handset such as the iPhone is really a internet in your pocket. It, by the way, does telephone calls, if that's what you want to do. And I think it's heading more and more that way with, you know, computing on demand, either on the device itself or more likely on, you know, some server bank it connects to somewhere in the cloud, as it's currently called. Yes, and that will change life in ways hard to predict. But, yeah, the ubiquity of computing is certainly another direction going forward. Other smart people work on that. I tend to be focused more narrowly on the topic we've been discussing.
I guess with 4 billion mobile handsets, you really have 4 billion users that have supercomputing in their pockets, potentially because it can connect to the cloud.
Exactly. And, you know, sort of what do you want to know or do? And it's an interesting time, you know, and on that side, the usage models. Totally, you know, there's no conflict. I mean, that's a usage model, and what I've been talking about is a sort of lower level, closer to the metal, you know. So if you're a programmer designing for any of these things, really, on the server side in the cloud, or on the handset side, I mean, the same trend that pushed desktop and laptop and server chips to go many core, those same physics considerations are going to prevail on the handset too. So you already see, at least dual core, low power handset or tablet oriented processors coming along. So the parallel stuff is going to show up there too, if you're a software developer.
Well, I'm not going to ask a sort of a broader question, and you can choose a topic area, but what do you see as the top challenge facing us today?
Oh, so I'm going to preface this with one of those inspiring statements from Richard Feynman. And, you know, when we were sitting around the lounge late in the afternoon and in the dark winter in Montreal, someone asked him a question very similar to that. And he said, you know, I'm good at certain things, but for, you know, addressing big issues facing the world or facing humans, I'm no more qualified than anyone else is. And that's one of the things, that sort of lesson in humility has at least statement has stuck with me, and try to follow that. It's so, you know, I'm really no more qualified to comment on global warming than is the next, you know, informed scientist, let's say, who's not a specialist in it. So I would confine my answer to, you know, what are the challenges in computer science education, something I'm a little bit closer to and maybe have sight on. And it turns out we have, there's a group of us writing an article. It will be published presently in Communications of the ACM on exactly this topic. So, yeah, what are the challenges? So the fact that the whole sort of discipline of teaching, not just computer science, but all the adjacent disciplines. So, you know, all those folks who need to use computing, who need to do a certain amount of programming, maybe beyond, you know, MATLAB, in order to get their own jobs done. They're not necessarily computer scientists. So in a way, you could think of computer science itself as, almost like math in the sense that, you know, a math department in a university will generate a certain number of math majors, but mostly they service or they enable a large number of other disciplines for which the math is critical. And computer science is kind of taking that role. You know, the computational thinking is really a benefit to many. I mean, it's quite obvious in some of the physical sciences and engineering. Maybe the computational thinking is a benefit beyond even those, you know, closely adjacent disciplines. So I think one of the challenges in computer science education is to sort that out. You know, what is the role, you know, beyond what's been done traditionally? And there's an interesting opportunity now. If there's a revamp, you know, if it really is true that the courses need to be revamped more frequently, you know, than has been the case, you know, in the past, that's an opportunity. You know, it's a work, you know, it's a workload, certainly, if you're an educator. But it allows the sort of the kernel, the computer science department, to adapt more quickly to follow opportunities where, you know, computational thinking is becoming important. In other healthcare, for example, my goodness, is wide open. So I think that's the biggest challenge and opportunity for computer science education.
So, Michael, one final question comes to mind, and there's this UN-founded body called the International Federation for Information Processing, and they launched an initiative called IP3, and the purpose of this is to create a global standards in computing, you know, have adherence to a code of ethics, demonstrated continued professional development, all sort of encompassed in professional certification, which is going to be sort of distributed worldwide through professional societies around the world. And it really, it's the first sort of solid attempt to create a profession out of IT. Do you have any sort of comments on that program or just on that concept in general of creating a profession out of IT?
I think it's a noble concept, but, you know, connect that. So I certainly wouldn't discourage it. But I wonder, what does that mean by IT? You know, I guess it would, the effort that you mentioned. I'm only a little bit familiar with it, but my understanding is, as you say, it's for IT professionals, not so much for the folks who may do very similar work, but in service of other disciplines or, you know, in service of other domains. So one question that I would pose to the folks doing that is, you know, given that computing, the practice of computing goes well beyond traditional IT, are they looking ahead, you know, to the adjacent areas for that? But it's, you know, I certainly applaud the intent of what they're doing and wish them well.
So I guess what you're saying is sort of the multidisciplinary aspect that occurs right now in computing in general.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, Michael, you know, with your extensive history at the intersection of research, technology, and education, we are really fortunate to have you come in and do this interview, so thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. It's fun.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Michael Rinn, Manager, Innovative Software Education, Intel Corporation.